We are very happy on the Roadhouse to have Lonnie Dupree joining us. In fact, we're very happy to have Lonnie Dupree back in Grand Marais. Lonnie, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Hi, Buck. Hi, Dick. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Nice to be home.
For those of you who have been, I don't know, in some other planet other than right here in Cook County or in the state of Minnesota or across the globe, Lonnie has just completed the first solo trip up the slopes of Denali, also known as Mount McKinley, in the month of January in the depths of winter in that location. And Lonnie, it's great. It's taken four trips up there.
Oh, yeah. It's been a long run for me. I'm going to be really careful the next time I bite something off this big. Because it's good. It actually hasn't even quite sunken in completely yet, because I just came off the mountain a little bit ago and been running ever since. And it's been nice. I got home last night, and so it's been nice just to relax and enjoy being home and seeing folks. And
you know, when you say it's big, it was a big mountain, but it's also as Outside Magazine said, they mentioned that it's the most significant mountaineering event among contemporary mountaineers. That's a big thing to say, and that's what I'm hearing in a lot of publications.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that from outside. But, you know, Denali is, it's humbling a mountain, Buck, as you know. You know, when we climbed it, was it in 2010 or 9?
2010, yeah.
2010, so we approached the mountain, you know, with a lot of big aspirations, and then you get there, and it's so humbling, and that mountain that you can see from Anchorage, 100 miles away, takes up the majority of the skyline. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at it and you're going, oh, boy. I mean, how did that even come to be, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting. We got such a huge landmarker in our own backyard in the United States. And if anybody ever gets a chance to get up there, or if you haven't had a chance to get up there to Alaska to see Denali, it's worth the view for sure.
And the weather there year round, it's kind of self-created around that mountain.
Yeah, Denali is very, very close to the Arctic Circle, so it's extremely cold, and it's right up against the Bering Sea. So the Bering Sea, as most folks know, it creates a lot of bad weather, and so that trickles on to Denali, and it almost creates its own little weather patterns there in just north of Anchorage. So the weather is often, you know, changes every 2-3 hours. And so that's what made it so difficult to get up.
And the weather, of course, is much more exacerbated in January than it was in June when we climbed it earlier. So you have a lot more things to face out there.
Well, there's that, and it's dark.
And it's dark.
It's really dark up there. And that really got to me this year, actually. I had, there's 18-hour nights. So your nights are 18-hour long, and you only have 5 to 7 hours of usable light to actually strap on your crampons and get up the mountain in light that you need in order to be safe, in order to crossing crevices or just needing to be able to see your footing and things like that. But the nights are long, and especially they're really long, and what really undermines a lot of my effort giddy up and go, I guess, is when the weather turns foul and you're stuck in a tent for 5.5 days. And it's just like, you know, you're trying to get motivated to do this thing, and then all of a sudden this storm comes in, and 5.5 days you're stuck sitting in a tent that's half the square footage of a sheet of plywood. And so staring at the ripstop nylon flapping for 5.5 days with little or no food was tough on me this year, because I made a very a mistake that could have cost me my life. I was going from 10,000 up to 11,000 feet. I deposited half of my load at 10,000 feet, which was majority of my food and fuel. And then I carried on and set up camp at 11,200 feet, thinking in the morning I'll just do the 10-minute ski down to my cache and pick up whatever food and fuel I need. And whammo, a big storm hit. It was blowing snow sideways, and I couldn't get out of my I couldn't hardly get out of within a few feet of my tent for 5.5 days. And so I looked and calculated what I had with me, and basically I had a lunch and then one full day's of food. So I knew I needed to stretch that out because I knew the weather forecast was going to be rough. And then I looked at my fuel, and I had about 22 ounces of fuel, which can be stretched to about 3 days, 3-4 days. So I'm short of fuel, I'm short of food, and I knew I got a long stay there. So what I ended up doing was staying in my sleeping bag as long as I could each day to conserve not only fuel from getting the stove started, and but also energy, and that meant, you know, just conserving my food. And so and I made my day and a half food a stretch for 5 days, 5.5 days.
And the fuel is crucial because you need water.
Yeah, without fuel, you only last about 48 hours, and then you're done because you dry up. And you need the liquid, you need to be hydrated, you need to have food in you in order to fight off the elements. And no matter what kind of gear you have, whether it's, you know, a 40 below down sleeping bag or really good clothing, it's just not going to cut it. Because those, while that's really good equipment, it doesn't create heat. Your body creates the heat that keeps you alive. And I think of my food as throwing logs on the fire, right?
Well, every year that you've gone up there in the winter now, and this was the fourth time, it seems like the weather has been different. So you really can't plan the same way.
Well, you know, we were just talking about this earlier today with a friend of mine, is that the expeditions that we were planning years ago, you could actually read up on and learn about climate and conditions that you would face when you're crossing the Arctic Ocean, or whether you're going to the South Pole. You could read about Shackleton. You could understand those things. Today, the weather is so fickle due to climate change that you cannot plan ahead like that anymore. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. It's impossible. And so, I don't know where I was going with that, but it's just like it's really super disappointing, and it's just been as short as a few decades, right? So,
and 1 year, I think that was maybe two times ago, lower on the mountain, it was raining inside your tent.
Yeah, and this year I had sleet at 11,200 feet. So I woke up, I got out of my tent, and I'm shoveling the snow away, and I looked at my shovel, and I had a half an inch of frozen rain on the outside of my shovel. It's just like this has never happened. I talked to Dave Johnston, who was the first a team member who was the first. It was the first expedition that made a winter ascent to Denali, not in January, but I think it was February. And temperatures back then, and they can still be that way today, are 40, 50 below zero at the summit. And lower on the mountain is well below zero. So having this kind of rain is just really unheard of. And actually, I was sitting in the tent, and I have a little transistor radio from Radio Shack. And I tied a little piece of copper wire to it, and I'm listening to the radio. And they reported that a family who feeds birds in Bethel, Alaska, had a robin turn up at their feeder in January. I mean, how crazy is that?
Yeah. Huh? Yeah.
And so there's just huge weather systems that we can't, that's making it difficult not only for people, but for, you know, wildlife and stuff to make a go of it, coming down the pike every year. And so.
And the rain I was referring to inside your tent a couple years ago was just because it was so warm and so much snow you were getting kind of buried. Now, you had a lot of snow again this year.
Yeah, when your tent gets buried and you get almost like you're inside of a snow cave, the temperature will elevate, of course, and then the condensation created on the ripstop nylon will often melt and drip on everything.
Which is not good.
No. It's a hypothermic type of situation. So the main thing is just trying to stay dry and comfortable. But those times where deep snow and the storms blowing and stuff, it was you really had to train your brain to just try to stay positive, and you push those negative thoughts out of your brain as much as you can, because you can easily talk yourself out of the whole project and thinking about, whoa, that warm shower in Talkeetna is sure going to feel good, or, you know, a nice crisp green salad will, you know, make feel good, or missing folks and stuff. So you really just kind of got to push that out of your brain and say, well, you know, I'm healthy, I'm secure, I'm progressing okay. So you just got to be positive mm-hmm. as much as possible, and not try to get those negative thoughts to undermine your whole goal.
How many days were you on the mountain this trip, Lonnie?
586. Oh, yeah. give or take little bit. But no, it was 29 days.
Uh-huh. That's a long time.
29 days is a long time. Yeah, I was thinking back on all the project, on all the attempts, and I think we're approaching 90 days that I've spent on that mountain trying to get up it. Mm-hmm. Over the years.
Yeah.
I should have my head examined.
Well, but you made it this year.
Yeah, it felt really good. I took a direct route to the summit because I was running a little late. According to my schedule, I wanted 9 hours up, about 3 hours down. I was running a little late, so I took a more direct route to the summit and did some fairly steep climbing. I was fairly exhausted by the time I got to the top. I still wasn't sure, even as I was approaching the summit, if I was ever going to get there. And I never allowed myself to think that I was going to get there, because I didn't want the rug pulled out from under me and then having to deal with the emotional disappointment. So I just took it really kind of just as it happened. And I seen the summit a few hundred yards away and realized I might make it there, you know. And I got up there, and when I finally got right to the peak, I broke down, because it was there's been a lot of difficulties over the last few years and trying to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And allowed myself 10 minutes to stay there, and then skedaddled down, you know, because the weather turning quite a bit. So so what took me 9 hours to get up, I got down in 3 hours and 15 minutes.
Which
I got
is back. Fast.
Which is pretty fast. Yeah. It's probably faster than you'd want to descend, because most fatalities happen on the way down because of footing and that kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. I was being quite careful with my footing. And I just wanted to be able to get back to camp with enough usable light to be able to actually find it and not be, sleeping outside without a sleeping bag or anything, because it's quite possible you wouldn't survive staying outside without a tent mm-hmm. and a sleeping bag. So I gave myself enough time to at least spot where the vicinity of my camp was, and I was able to wiggle around through the rocks and found it.
Well, when you're climbing alone, it's a much different climb safety-wise than it is when you have a team of people climbing, when you can rope together. For instance, just going up that final ridge up to the top, it doesn't take much of a mistake.
No, it's always if you're roped to another person and you guys communicate well together, then if a person falls, they can yell falling, and the other folks will do the self-arrest with the axes and try to stop your fall. So there's some sense of security there. I think I just, personally, I always remembered that I wasn't tied in, or I always made it very clear that I wasn't, to myself, that I wasn't attached to anything, and that I really needed to be careful. And I think I was, given the last three attempts where I just decided to pull the plug on it because it's too much, too dangerous. Yeah. So, This year, I felt good. I had a short, very short weather window. I knew I needed to get the summit that day, or not at all. But when I left camp at 5 o'clock in the morning to start that climb, I looked around and the wind was blowing. It didn't look like a summit day, and I thought, well, I'm all dressed up for the party. I might as well just keep going. I can always turn around, right? And the further I got up, the closer I got to the summit, and the weather calmed down enough to instill enough confidence in me that I could keep moving forward. And then eventually I was there, and it was just like, oh, this is nice. Yeah. I think I'm gonna stay here a few minutes. I'm gonna get down, you know.
And, yeah.
And
it had to be a huge emotional, a big relief and a huge emotional moment for you, just being there.
Yeah, it was a funny feeling, because I didn't feel like jumping up and down and excited about it. It was just like a real humble feeling that, oh, I'm allowed to get here, and they are letting me live so far, you know. Mm-hmm. It's letting me live so far. So it's just like, oh, thank you. Okay, now I'm going to just like, you know, backtrack and get out of here and try to get down before dark. And
you carried a big spruce pole, I believe.
Well, in the early part of the trip, down on the crevice fields, I carried a 12-foot-long, 6-inch spruce pole that I just cut out of the bog in Talkeetna there. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was better than a ladder. That was actually quite a bit lighter. I could actually use my persic cord and attach that pole to my hip belt. And then if I ever fell in a crevice, I could use that pole and persic up the side of the pole to get out, to help get out.
And that's a mountaineering method of climbing by yourself.
Yeah, it's a special loop you put on a piece of rope and then attach it, and you can actually, it locks in as you climb up. So I was going to do that. And then, of course, as I got up further, I didn't need the pole because it was too heavy, and I started running out of crevices that were dangerous, so I didn't need it then. And then on summit day, it was just crampons on boots and one ice axe, and I went extremely light. I was always debating, should I carry a pack with food, sleep bag, you know, all that stuff. But all I ended up carrying was one ice axe, two candy bars, 4 liters of fluid, and that was it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to travel, because being fast is also being safe. Being light is being safe. Not necessarily being fast, but just being light and being able to move, and instead of being encumbered with other stuff. But the downside of that is you got to go up and you have to come back down that same night. You can't be stuck. If you get stuck, you probably wouldn't survive the evening. So my thought is I would go up, and if it looked like the weather was getting bad, I would just hightail it down in a hurry. And so that was my method of being light and just ready to go. And I think the key to the success of that trip was, or to summit day anyways, was being well hydrated is a key, keeping your being able to move freely and keeping your muscles hydrated. And that was the biggest thing. And I learned that technique from Vern Tejas, who has been up Denali, you know, dozens of times.
And around the world.
And so I got an insulated hydration pack and modified it in such a way that it wouldn't freeze, and put it on my back between underneath my down suit. And that, for me, that was the real key, is just staying hydrated.
Carry water and forget the food and forget the
You can live weeks without food, right?
Yeah, you don't need all those bars when you're up and down. And
they don't taste good anyway.
Well, no. you built one piece of equipment yourself this time on the way up, and that was a pair of skis.
Yeah, actually, with the with the help of Mark Hansen from North House Folk School, I had some yellow birch from my property in Hovland, Minnesota, and air dried that lumber, and we carved out a pair of long, 4-inch wide, 8-foot long birch skis. I call anti-crevice skis. And it's just to be able to allow you to ski across the surface, less pounds per square inch, so you're not busting through bridges and stuff, and moving my way up the mountain. And you can only use the skis to 11.2, but that's over the most creviced area of the mountain. So once you get past that, I can rely on my spruce pole for a little bit further, and then from there on, it's you're pretty much on your own, and the crevices aren't too bad higher up.
What was harder, climbing the mountain or navigating all the media when you got done?
You know, it's been quite a whirlwind. You know, yeah. Stevie Plummer, who's been the project coordinator, has really been handling the brunt of that, and she's doing a great job. It's been a whirlwind. It got a lot of attention. I'm not sure why.
Well,
really,
I think we are.
Yeah. But maybe somebody was offering free hot dogs. I have no idea. But
you didn't get a lot of sleep when you got off that mountain.
No, it feels like I still could use a little bit. But it's been fun, and able to visit with a lot of folks in the media world that have followed some of our past trips and stuff. So it's like reconnecting with old folks. Yeah, it's been fun. It's fun to be able to tell the story, and really, it's about for me. I would like a lot of these outdoor adventures to really inspire and instill not only children and young adults, but people in general, just to get out and enjoy the outdoors. And that, and if we all have a little piece of that outdoors in our heart, it helps us learn to kind of protect it, because we're getting less and less wild areas in this world. So,
well, it's hard to find anything much wilder in the winter than the top of Denali. that's out there.
That's for sure.
Yeah, you know, we talked earlier in the day. We were having a little coffee and we were talking about the flight that came in to pick you up, and they couldn't land.
Yeah,
but I think we kind of take for granted that. Okay, we're just going to fly out. It's not quite that simple.
Right, right. And people also think you can get, like, rescued when you're up there.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very difficult environment, even in your perfect conditions, to fly into Denali, because, one, you have very low light conditions at that time of year, and it's stormy. And weeks can go by before you have a window to actually fly in.
And but the route is difficult for the pilot.
Yeah, and even though they're some of the best glacial pilots in the world, they're always monitoring the weather and on edge a little bit about flying in there.
Mm-hmm. And you have to go around some pretty steep terrain.
Yeah, I mean, they're flying through, 10,000-foot mountains with little cracks in them that they fly through these passes called one-shot pass. You know, it's like I asked the pilot, what do you mean by one-shot pass, you know?
It's just what he said.
Don't you have, like, a two-shot pass? I want to go through the two-shot pass, you know? I want to increase my odds by, like, 50% of surviving this flight.
Yeah.
But, so it is amazing, as you know, Buck, flying into that area. It's just, it's almost life-changing, just the flight into those places. So, those pilots are amazing, and we when we plan an expedition like this into the Alaska Range, you have to be totally self-sufficient. You can't assume you're going to be rescued because of the weather, or because people rescuing aren't acclimated, or what have you. So there's just so many parameters to that. They can't fly in and land at any location, and helicopters can only fly so high, and there's a lot of variables in that. So you pretty much, when you go in there, you got to pretty much be completely self-sufficient, and, you know, even if you end up breaking a leg or something, you got to have stuff with you that's going to keep you comfortable, whether it's painkillers or taking care of an injury until somebody can get to you, or do an airdrop or what have you. But we plan that way.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just a matter of climbing a mountain. It's climbing a mountain alone in the winter that makes it such a remarkable feat. There's an element, constant danger.
Yeah, it's really super raw because you got to be kind of okay with knowing that you might not make it in order to focus on what you're doing. And mm-hmm. so if you go into the thing project afraid that you could die, you're not going to be focusing on the job at hand. Yeah. So it's a pretty raw deal.
Yeah.
And it's tiring because the amount of decisions you make every day are based really close to whether you make it or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so by the end of the day or the end of the week or whatever, it's like you're all played out, like, oh, you know, I wish somebody could make these decisions for me, but that ain't gonna happen.
Yeah. we were talking with Sam Cook, editor, sports editor at the Duluth News Tribune, and your friend as well as mine and Dick's, and he mentioned for all those people that are sitting out there saying, you know, why is he a little crazy to be doing this in January? And we talked quite a bit about your skill set, your background in the Arctic, and what an advantage that is to you to be on that particular mountain, and also just doing these things in general. You may take some things in stride that the average person would be, you know, not able to do.
Certainly, I think only because I've been doing this for so many years, it's maybe a little easier for me because I've just been doing it for so long. But it's I don't know. It's really tough because I try some stuff. I just imagine that people understand or realize, but they don't. Sometimes they don't because
you can be comfortable at 50 below, and the average person would be freaked out.
Yeah, and it's just again experience. It's not, you know. It's just that's what I do, and I've been doing it for a long time, and I understand what, you know, how to incorporate clothing, equipment, and food. Really being in tune with how my body's feeling, whether it's dehydrated or needs something to eat or that kind of stuff. And so it's all about being comfortable out there, right? And so we just understand all these techniques and little tricks that just make life much more comfortable for us. And you adapt to it over time, I think. And I think it's not that we're any, you know, we got any special thing running through our blood or anything. You know, it keeps us from freezing solid. You know, it's just.
Are you sure?
Well, there may be some this evening, but typically there's not. And years of just preferring winter over summer and learning to adapt to it.
And doing that.
Yeah.
You've got a couple of things else that we should talk about, and one is your movie. Documentary that you have out, and I know it played in Salt Lake. It's called Cold Love. Yeah. And you'll have to do a little editing now to add the summit.
Yeah. Maybe. Actually, it's an hour and 10 minute long, and we're trying to whittle it down to 50 minutes. And then Daya is putting the last little bit of video that I shot of getting to the summit of Denali to put a conclusion to that, which is, so we kind of left that part open because we never knew if that was ever going to happen. Uh-huh. And so I got a little bit of footage for that. She's putting the end to that. And we showed it out in Salt Lake and in Anchorage recently at the International Film Festival there. And people seem to enjoy it. So that's great.
It's nice. It reached a point now where you can have a circuit that can travel on?
Yeah, I would say in the next week and a half that final editing will be done, and then it gets put on gets burned onto CDs, and we can sell it online. But it will then also go to international or film festivals around the United States. But there'll be a few overseas too that it will go to, like in Spain or France.
And your book, the latest book,
Life on Ice. Yep, we've been pushing that a little bit, but. There's been so much going on. I just haven't done much with it. But we've been taking it a lot to presentations and stuff, and people have been liking it, so that's great.
Sure. But for people to take a peek at that, they can go to your website to learn more about it.
Yeah, both the film and the book, you can go to oneworldendeavors.com and check that out. There's also, if you haven't followed the expedition, there's some information about that. And then we're starting to think about what's down the pike, but we're also tired from this last trip.
Sure, exactly.
We're just thinking about drinking coffee and eating like bonbons.
Well, at some point you'll be out there giving talks, and people get a chance to meet you around. And if they can keep track of your website, they'll learn when those things are happening.
Yeah, and I want to thank so much for all the support we got within the community. This is a wonderful community to come back to, and we've been supported by many businesses here. It's just been wonderful that way. And so it just feels like coming home and hanging with good friends and enjoying the later parts of winter, where you can just go out and ski and relax and not worry about the tourist season quite yet.
Well, we're all happy that you call this your home, Len.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Lenny. Lenny Dupree, who just completed a January summit solo of Mount Denali, better known as Mount McKinley to many folks out there. Dick, did you have something you want to bring up? Yes, Len?
No, well, I didn't want to intervene in your interview here, but I've seen Lonnie's film and I've read his book, and they're both, I highly recommend them to anybody who hasn't seen the movie or the film, and I'm going to have to see it again now that you're going to add this knowledge on it. But the book, Life on Ice, is a very interesting book and well written, and
Thank you, Dick.
It's just really, really fun. So I highly recommend that.
Well, we want to thank you so much again, Lon, and we hope that you get better nourished and better rested in the weeks to come.
Thanks, you guys. Always a pleasure.